Last year, I filed my taxes for the first time in about 5 years, and I was scared. I felt like my situation was different, my situation was complicated. During that time, I had been fully employed, I had been freelancing, and I had lived overseas. By the time I finally asked my friends for recommendations on a tax professional, I was pretty sure I was going to go broke and maybe to jail. That's absolutely not the way it went down. With the help of my tax guy, I had the fines that had been piling up reduced drastically, and I even got a big tax refund that I had been due for years that more than made up for the fines. In this episode, Lucas and I talked to Julian Brookstone, a certified financial planner and tax professional who was recommended in a thread in the Resource Creative Forum. He wrote an excellent introductory article to Tax for Creative Freelancers, which you can find on his website. Guys, if you don't know what to do about tax, listen to this episode and just get it done. It's not as difficult or scary as you think. Without further ado, we bring you Julian Brookstone. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Resource Cast. This is Season 2, Episode 2, and today we are talking about tax, the most terrifying topic for every creative freelancer. Especially for Lucas, who has only been doing this for about a year or so. I mean, Luke, you've been... Welcome to the show, first of all. How are you doing?
No, not too bad. Thank you.
Okay, cool. Don't care. So Lucas has been...
usually you forget. I'm honored.
And we're also joined today by Julian Brookstone. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, guys.
Cool, and thank you very much for sharing your time with us. Julian has a very... You've got a very James Bondy spy name. Julian Brookstone sounds like a, kind of a Pelican Briefy kind of name.
Really? Well, yeah, weirdly, I mean, considering my surname is made of two very common words, it's a very uncommon surname, so maybe it's got a air of mysticism about it.
Yeah, it just sounds kind of mystery.
Cool, thank you. Now, probably not exactly conveying my actual personality, but anyway.
Badass tax guy.
Speaking of badass tax guys, the tax guy that doesn't look like a tax guy at all.
Like, yeah.
You do look like you stepped off stage.
My hair is especially long right now, I guess, because I haven't had it cut since lockdown started. But for the most part, I probably don't look like the typical tax guy.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear that you're a musician as well.
I mean, I've been playing drums since age 12, and I've played in a bunch of bands in the past. And I guess kind of how my network around creative started. So although I'm in the tax field, at heart, I'm a creative. And, you know, for my first couple of years practicing, I used to, you know, wear a suit and stuff and all that kind of vibe. But it just didn't really feel like me. And at some point, I just decided I've got to be myself. And people who don't want to work with me when I'm being myself are people that I don't necessarily want to work with anyway. But, you know, no one seems to have an issue.
Yeah, look, I think that's going to serve you in great stead in the creative community, like, you know, people who aren't necessarily turned on by suits and ties. What percentage of your clientele would you say is in some way creative?
Probably 80 to 90% even.
Wow.
Really most of them. I think it's because my practice is... has grown primarily through word of mouth, and my initial network was creative individuals. So from then, it's just, you know, expanded in those areas.
Well, you got lucky in that case. I mean, because you kind of get the first few clients from, obviously, from your network, and then it kind of grows that way. But imagine your first client had been, you know, like a printer, or, well, no, printers are slightly creative, but something, I don't know, like a, what's an incredibly, like a, like legal, you know, could be.
Yeah, like imagine my first client was a tax practitioner.
I'd love that. That would have been very interesting, like a snake eating itself.
So yeah. It's funny. I do tax for like some financial planners and stuff, which is interesting. But actually, for the most part, I don't deal a lot with other people in the financial services industry because they're just not really part of my network. And in a way, I think that benefits me because they're also not really in my clients' networks, you know? So.
And you're an independent, right? So you're not connected to any particularly large company?
Yeah. Well, to give a bit of background, I initially started practicing as a financial planner. So that was after graduating from university with BCom in financial planning. And through my financial planning practice, I've always operated through, you know, various FSPs. Currently, my financial planning practice, which still exists, is running through Masthead Financial Planning, through which I'm basically a representative and run my business through them for some kind of admin and compliance support. But on the tax side of things, from the beginning, I've always just been operating as myself, as Julian Brookstone. It's a completely separate business to the financial planning.
Right.
And so essentially, I'm like a freelance tax practitioner. And I guess that also gives me insight into helping freelancers.
Sure. And what's your perception of the way most creative freelancers see their taxes?
Basically, what is the mess that they hand over to you?
It's interesting. Obviously, a lot of people are intimidated to the degree that they don't really take action, which is, you know, understandable. When you're overwhelmed by you know, all the information, sometimes you just don't know what to do. But what I've found quite interesting is that generally when people come to me and they just think their situation is such a mess and they're going to owe SARS tons of money, they haven't done returns in years and years, you know, I get them back up to date. It's like much easier than they were expected. And they end up getting paid a bunch of money by SARS that they weren't expecting. And they're always just like, wow, why was I putting this off for so long, you know? There is obviously the flip side where someone's been putting off tax and now they do owe SARS like 100K, and that's obviously terrible. But for the most part, tax ends up being less scary for people than what they were expecting, I find.
Sure.
Is that because the systems have been made easier for freelancers, or is it because what do you think are the reasons? Because in my head, it always feels like from the get-go, do I have to go into SARS to do this stuff, or do you do this all online? What are the background systems?
It's called e-filing now.
Yeah, so yes, e-filing totally. Definitely makes life a lot easier. To be honest, if it wasn't for e-filing, I wouldn't operate a tax practice, because going to SARS is probably the worst thing imaginable. And thankfully, I've only been there a handful of times, and it's normally for sorting out my own stuff. If someone wants to take control of their own taxes, then e-filing does make it easy in the sense that it's very easy to submit your returns and to interface with SARS. Obviously, it's still complicated to understand, you know, tax itself and all the different legal intricacies and stuff like that. But I find generally for freelancers, what makes it less intimidating than what they expected is just there's a general misunderstanding of tax. And I think that a lot of people, you know, probably out of anxiety, just assume that they don't understand it. And that obviously means that they definitely owe SARS a bunch of money and there's going to be all this trouble and they're going to go to jail. They don't sort this stuff out soon. And it's really like never actually the case, you know. Most of the time, people don't really owe SARS money if they've had tax deducted on their behalf. There are obviously exceptions. And most of the time, SARS really isn't in a hurry to like send people off to jail. You know, they'll give you a lot of chances to fix things up before it gets to that point. And people are just kind of, you know, they're scared by the fact that it is a serious topic and they don't want to mess it up. But in reality, it's not that hard to do.
So if just from like now, because I see this podcast has been to me like free advice. So so without alluding to what a mess my life is, it'll be like not giving it out of completely. Let's say I know a guy that needs to
register.
I'm asking for a friend. How do we start? Where do you start?
So registering for taxes, probably one of the most painful parts of the process, because that isn't something that you can do on e-filing. But what generally happens is if you've ever had a salaried job, that employer would have registered you for tax. Like basically an individual can register themselves for tax by going to a SARS branch, or an individual's employer can register them for tax when initially bringing them on for employment if they're not already registered. I, as a tax practitioner, can't register someone for tax. So when people aren't registered, that's the first step that they need to take themselves. But from there on, you know, people like me can obviously help them with everything.
Okay, so once you have an e-filing account, essentially then you're rolling.
Well, registering for tax doesn't automatically result in an e-filing account. That's still something that needs to be done. But that you can just do online. You register, you often then get asked by SARS to submit like your ID and some documents to them. And if they don't have any issue with those documents, then your e-filing account is activated. And then obviously you can handle your taxes and you can see your tax profile, past returns and stuff like that. For someone who wants a tax practitioner to help them out, they don't actually need to have their own e-filing account. But I generally recommend it anyway, because it's just nice for someone to be able to check back on their past returns if they're looking for some information, or if they just want to keep tabs on their tax practitioner to make sure that stuff has actually been done. So I think it's always worthwhile to just register an e-filing account, and that you can do online easy.
Right.
Okay, cool. I have an account. Now I have money coming in. Now what?
So I guess one of the most important concepts to understand is that you're only ultimately taxed on your profits, right? So if you have a lot of expenses which you incur in the production of your income, most of those expenses to some degree can be deducted from that income before arriving at your actual taxable amount. You know, for a salaried individual, it's kind of the default that their employer is going to cover any costs associated with that job. But as a freelancer, you invariably have certain expenses you just wouldn't have if you weren't running your own business. So those are the kind of things that are tax deductible. And you ideally want to know what those expenses are and keep track of them to bring your taxable income down as low as possible.
Yeah, I mean, and that's...
What are these things?
Sorry, John. No, it's cool. I'll tell you because I'm going to say that we are basing a lot of this conversation on Julian's article, which is called Tax, a Crash Course for Freelancers. And I just want to reiterate what he's saying here is that like the deductibles that you get, which are basically the expenses that it costs for you to run your business, which are salaries, rental, the home office, telephone, internet, marketing, research and development, web design, web hosting. So if you've got your own portfolio of sites that you pay monthly fees for, that's covered. Equipment and stationery, depreciation of equipment, admin, banking fees, finance charges, travel, client entertainment, meeting costs and lunches. All that stuff is, and I mean, I'm going to use the meme term here, is free money. Like when you claim that stuff, it's taking it away from the taxes you have to pay. So yeah, there's an incredible incentive to actually get that stuff right. Because you're just saving the cash.
Frame that in a way which gives it some perspective. Mm. You know, basically any expense that you claim as a tax deduction is ultimately going to reduce your tax, right? And the amount that it reduces your tax by is proportional to your tax rate. So for example, if someone's in the 39% tax bracket and they spend 1,000 rand on, let's say 10,000 rand on having a website designed, they're essentially getting, you know, 39% discount on that cost through the tax savings. Obviously, then right, the higher your tax rate is, the bigger essentially that discount is that you're getting. So I guess one silver lining to being in a high tax bracket. But right, the golden rule with regards to expenses is that if the expense is incurred in the production of your income, in other words, if you wouldn't have that expense if you weren't running this business, then that expense is at least going to be partially tax deductible. I say partially because sometimes there are formulas and you have to apportion things and stuff like that.
So obviously, if you've got a computer, you keep your receipts with the computer. If you're paying for internet, the receipts, I always wondered, how do they keep track of these things? Is it like physically keeping every receipt and then giving it to someone like you or submitting it to SARS? It's these like, as an example, like for every cup of coffee you go and buy during the day while you're working, is that now part of your, if for a client meeting or whatever, do you keep that?
Yeah.
Do you have a big box of receipts?
I think in practice, people don't really have a big box of receipts these days. It's definitely been a number of years since someone gave me a big box of receipts to look through. You know, one issue about receipts, well, you know, till slips, is that they sit in your wallet for 3 weeks and they come out and they're like blank already, which isn't ideal.
I always thought that was on purpose, so you couldn't really.
I know, right? I've also wondered about that. But because like, why else would they fade so quickly? But anyway, I mean, let's not get into that kind of stuff. The nice thing is that these days, most people are operating you know, paying for stuff with their cards, and inevitably all these records, or 90% of them, are going to be on their bank statements. So that's often proof enough for SARS. There are certainly cases where SARS will ask to see bank statements and possibly an invoice or something, but it's quite rare. Having said that, you do want to make sure that you have proof if it's ever asked for, you know. But I'd say that maybe keeping track of like every copy slip is a step too far. But if you go and buy a laptop for $20,000, maybe keep that slip, you know. And otherwise, you can just rely on your bank statements.
So when it comes to apps like Zapper and SnapScan, they obviously keep payment history for small things like coffees and that kind of vibe. Are those submissible? Are those, can you just send that PDF?
I can't answer that with from an experience point of view, because I've never actually submitted something like that to SARS. SARS has never asked to see proof of anything for which that would have been a reasonable way to provide it. Because in reality, SARS doesn't ask for proof much unless something looks weird in your return. But I think that in practice, yes, you could provide something like that as proof, yeah. SARS is quite understanding, you know. They're ultimately humans on the other side, and you can have conversation with them. Well, via letters and stuff, not necessarily on the phone.
You might just ping on their system because you're spending 4,000 rand a month on cappuccinos, and they go like, "Well, there's no way that's possible." It's like, "Yeah, it's possible."
Yeah, you have to be reasonable though, because I mean, if it turns out that someone ends up spending 4,000 rand a month on cappuccinos, and that means they've spent a quarter of their annual income on cappuccinos, that's obviously like a bit suspicious to SARS. Whereas if someone earns, you know, 1 million rand a year, then maybe SARS isn't going to be too concerned about 4,000 rand a month spent at coffee shops and meetings and stuff like that.
Sure.
But ultimately, I mean, if your claim is justifiable, if it's honestly an expense that you wouldn't have spent if you weren't running this business, then whatever it adds up to is legitimate, you know?
Now, in my experience, because I was, you know, to give context to my experience, I was the classic freelancer who I kind of was in and out of either freelancing or a paid job over a number of years, since 2011. And I lived overseas for a while and came back, and it was all terrifying, and I didn't handle any of it. And for about 5 years, there were no records. I didn't do a tax return, nothing. Mm. And I eventually did get in contact with my finance guy. I sent him all the stuff, and we managed to get the e-file. I didn't have an e-filing account, got that sorted out. And and I did, there were fees. I got harassed by collection agencies via SMS and phone, which I mostly ignored because I was advised by another financial advisor friend of mine who was just like, those dudes are scammers and you should just tell them basically.
Okay.
Anyway, I gave it all to him, and there were fees which he reduced massively, and I did get that payback from SARS, which completely annulled the fees and gave me some extra
as
well. Yeah. So that all worked out pretty well. And I found that the easiest way, if you are in the situation like that, is find a professional like Julian, and for the first catch up of everything you've screwed up in your life, like, let them help you. Luke?
John is saying that he's not getting any kickbacks from Julian. Julian's literally here because of this article he wrote, just as a provisor. So if you have a guy, it's cool as well. It's just, there's no bias here. It sounds like good advice. I just needed to set that up because that sounded very much like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like, this message is endorsed by Resource Guard.
New music for the podcast coming from Julian Brookstone very soon.
Well, I'm busy working on some stuff actually, but I have a curse of not being able to finish writing a song. I just started like 100 of them.
But my wife has the same issue. She's like this very artistic person, but doesn't finish a damn thing. So my suggestion to her was to start something like a book, but only fit all the half finished stuff in a book, which is
ideas I never finished. Yeah. The book and it doesn't finish
either. The book literally is halfway through. Blank page.
There's no back cover.
Yeah, totally.
Cool.
So one of the things though that I still haven't figured out, I've been freelance since I think
May 2019 now, is provisional tax. And that's the one of those big things that I've still, it's a big blank in my head. So can you explain that for us?
Sure. I think it is easy to get confused about provisional tax. One of the easily confusable aspects is that it's not actually a separate tax. You know, you're not paying provisional tax and paying income tax. Provisional tax is just a way to pay your income tax sooner than later, you know? So for an individual who operates, you know, on a salary basis, has their tax deducted from their salary every month, they obviously don't need to worry about provisional tax. But when someone's earning income that hasn't been taxed, SARS basically expects you to pay that tax throughout the year via these provisional returns. And the provisional returns are essentially just your opportunity to estimate your tax for the year and to pay the relevant portion to date. So by filing your provisional returns, then when you get to your annual return, which is also, you know, compulsory, but filed later, your tax for the most part is going to be paid unless there's maybe a slight under or overpayment based on previous estimations. But if you don't file your provisional returns, then when you get to the end of the tax year and you file your annual returns, you're going to have to pay that full financial year's worth of tax in one go. And SARS is also going to be adding penalties and interest and stuff on top of that. So it's definitely not ideal. The other tricky thing about provisional tax is just understanding the dates. And in general, tax dates often sound confusing because, like, right now we're in the 2021 tax year, but most of this tax year happens in 2020 because it started from the 1st of March. So tax years are essentially named after the year in which they end. So right now we're filing 2020 annual returns. Well, you know, in the next couple months, we're also going to be filing the first provisional return for the 2021 tax year. And it all just kind of get a little bit overwhelming and confusing when you have all these different dates and stuff going on.
Yeah, I literally started feeling anxiety as you were explaining that.
Yeah, totally. I think if there was a Google Calendar for that says right now, do this, this is what this is, that'd be rad. Also, it's almost like these things should be on calendars, like public holidays, when this happens.
I think in a way that's a good idea. You know, but ultimately, well, if you're handling your own tax, you should just check up on SARS's website and see when the relevant dates are. And if you've got a tax practitioner helping you out, then ideally, they're going to be getting in touch with you, you know, a month or two before each relevant date to just give you a heads up. Then you shouldn't miss anything.
You also touched on something there that made my, like, if you had a pulse rate monitor, heart rate monitor on me, it would have spiked. Is when you said SARS has different ways of, like, you pay penalties and and little. So it's, I'm assuming these are incentives to do your provisional tax at a certain, like, during the year versus at the end of the year. So, but it's when you said it sounded like quite severe.
Well, the thing is, it can be severe, and it really depends on how much tax you actually owe to SARS. Because, for example, if, let's take a really quite extreme example, let's say you owe them 100,000 rand. But you haven't paid provisional returns. And so you do your annual return and here comes this 100,000 rand tax bill. Because you missed the provisional returns, SARS is going to add an automatic 10% penalty onto that tax bill. So that's 10K. And on top of that, they're going to be charging you interest calculated from when you should have paid that tax at the provisional date. Depending on when you filed this annual return, it could already be like a year late, for example. In which case, you're going to be sitting with basically 20%, you know, extra interest and penalties that you wouldn't be paying otherwise. So in certain cases, it can be quite severe. Obviously, the less tax you owe, the less of an impact those penalties and stuff have. But it still doesn't change the fact that provisional returns are, you know, technically compulsory if you fall into that, you know, segment of people.
That sounds like loan shark rates. Holy crap. That's insane.
Well, the 10% penalty is quite steep, especially because they'll automatically apply that. So, you know, the provisional tax deadline, let's say in February, is, you know, at the end of February. So, and let's say this year it was 29th of February. If your payment arrives with SARS on the 1st of March, so one day late, you're already getting hit for that 10% automatic penalty. As far as the interest goes, I'd probably have to double check to be sure. Maybe it's changed slightly, but the SARS's interest rate is normally about 10% per year, which is not that bad, you know, compared to what you pay on a credit card or something like that. But obviously, when added to the penalties, it still ends up pretty steep, you know, punishment for missing the date.
So that 10% is actually somewhat above what you would get, because I was going to make the case that if you're investing the money that you would be paying provisionally in some kind of interest bearing account, then could you offset the costs for SARS? But it sounds like it's pitched just slightly above what you could reasonably expect to earn. Therefore, you might as well pay them.
Especially looking at the state of what's going on right now with the pandemic and the fact that the Reserve Bank has recently decreased the repo rate by almost 3%. So the amount of interest that you can reliably earn from a conservative investment currently is going to be way short of that 10% that SARS is charging.
Sure.
Whereas maybe, you know, up to a year ago, you could pretty easily find an investment that's going to reliably pay you, you know, 7% or so, in which case the difference is not huge. Whereas right now you might be looking at a difference of like 5 or 6%.
Sure. Now, as I understand it, with provisional tax, you are estimating how much you're going to make in the next few months. Is that correct?
The kind of standard methodology is to, at the first provisional date, which happens halfway through the financial year in August, at that point, you're supposed to base your estimation on what's happened so far. So you don't need to be completely accurate. SARS doesn't mind estimations with provisional returns unless they're way out. But what I'm getting at is that if for the first 6 months of the financial year you've earned, let's say, 100K, the normal methodology is then to just double that to account for the next half of the year. So then your estimated income for the year will be 200K. You work out what the tax on that amount is, and you essentially then pay half of it. Then when you get to the second provisional date at the end of the financial year, at that point, you've got the full year's worth of data, maybe not necessarily for the last little bit of February or whatever the case may be, but you can estimate quite accurately then. And you'll recalculate your tax based on your actual income. You'll minus off what you've already paid for the previous provisional date, and you'll just basically settle the balance. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. But then I guess the question comes with the pandemic is that everyone's incomes took a massive dip in April, and now hopefully they'll be recovering at some point. But it's obviously very hard to project anything. And the last thing people have right now is extra cash lying around to, you know, satisfy SARS. So like, what's the best way forward when it comes to provisional tax right now?
I mean, it's a very good question. And given the fact that, you know, this kind of thing hasn't really happened in the past, or at least as long as I've been practicing, I don't know exactly what the answer is. Because on the one hand, you've got a lot of people that for the first half of this financial year have earned much less than what they normally have, you know. So if they follow the normal methodology for calculating provisional tax, they might arrive at an estimated annual income of an extremely low amount because they're just doubling what's happened in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
Obviously, then the danger of that is then in the second half of the financial year, you end up earning more and then you pay quite a large amount of tax at the end because you basically paid nothing now. The flip side is that you kind of estimate to the best of your ability, taking into account what you expect to happen in the second half of the year, but then you're going to be paying tax right now on some income you haven't actually earned yet, you know? So I think for each individual, it's going to take a slightly different approach, and you'll have to find that balance between what you can afford now versus not leaving yourself in a position where you won't be able to afford the second tax payment. But look, ultimately, it's going to be very hard to make estimations right now. When you get to the end of the financial year, you'll be in a much better position to do a proper estimation of how the years went. And I imagine that SARS will be quite understanding about any like large under or over estimations which happen based on this first 6 months.
Right.
You know, if they do, for example, penalize you for an underestimation, maybe you'd have recourse to dispute that penalty on the basis that, you know, things were very unpredictable during this first half of the year.
Sure. And that disputation process seems to be, at least in my case, was very effective. Have you experienced that yourself? Have you had to dispute things and get charges reduced a lot?
Yeah. I mean, I've, in a way, it's surprising. SaaS has a lot of power to issue penalties, but it still seems quite rare to see them. For example, the case of penalties for not submitting returns. You know, sometimes I'll see an individual who hasn't submitted a return in 6 years and they haven't been issued one single penalty for non-submission. Other times you find an individual who is in a similar boat, but SaaS has issued them like 70K worth of penalties, which are just like, you know, 500 Rand added up a million times for like each month that something was late. In
can
cases
I ask,
like
can
that.
Can I ask you on that thing? Is that because of ineptitude or is that because of randomness? Is that like, why would that happen? Because in my head, it feels like it should be above, everybody should be getting the same type of treatment. And when you say that, and your experience, these things happen, is it, what is the reason for that?
It almost seems a bit random sometimes. Look,
is that
as
just
far
because
my
South Africa
goes, maybe. Look, I don't know. Okay. But as far as tax systems around the world go, you know, SARS has historically been quite actually jacked up. There's obviously been some traveling times in the last couple of years and stuff, but I don't know. I think it's random, or I think it might be that through some kind of third party source of information, they realize that this person hasn't filed in 7 years is actually earning hundreds of thousands a year. Which case that will like raise a red flag and then they'll start issuing penalties. Whereas someone who doesn't seem to raise those red flags might get away with no one at SaaS deciding, okay, cool, let's actually issue those penalties. So in a case with a client who had been issued 70K worth of penalties for a couple of returns that were outstanding, we eventually did those returns and realized that on the basis of those two particular returns that they'd issued all these penalties for, she didn't actually owe SARS anything. Technically, she should have been filing those returns. She did fall into the, you know, category of individuals who are required to submit. But because she didn't owe SARS anything for those years, you know, I submitted a disputes. I argued with them that they were in no way, negatively impacted by the fact that she hadn't filed those returns. In fact, they owed her money. So in a way, they got to hold on to that money a little bit longer. And anyway, they just reduced those penalties down to zero. Now, technically, they didn't have to because, yes, her returns were late. Yes, she should have filed them because she was earning essentially freelance income. But ultimately, they were understanding about it. But I think for someone who maybe shows clear, like, intention of avoiding tax by not filing returns, obviously those are the cases where they're not going to be lenient about reducing penalties.
Okay, so it is case by case, and there's a little bit of, like you said in the beginning, I'm glad you set that up, from there are humans on the other side to talk to, not just this kind of bureaucratic wall.
Yeah. Okay. You know, the bureaucracy shows its face most in the fact that for submitting disputes and dealing with audits and stuff, it's often like, you know, sending SARS documents and waiting for them to send you a letter via e-filing, requesting more documents or telling you the outcome of your case. You can very rarely actually like chat on the phone to the person who's auditing your return or handling your dispute. So you have to submit these letters and you end up often waiting weeks or months for feedback. But yeah, at the end of the day, the person that is sending that letter is a human being, and they are going to consider, you know, all the relevant facts about this case and assess it on its kind of individual merit.
Yeah. And I think that their goal, SARS's goal, is not to drive people out of business. It's to generate more taxable income by helping people build their business. And exactly. I think from most of the freelancers, look, I mean, I don't know, but I'm guessing that most of the creative freelancers that either you work with and in general on the resource are not earning 500,000 Rand a year. You know, they're probably pulling in between 25 and 50 grand a month, which makes you a pretty small target on their, you know, on their radar.
Yeah. You think SARS doesn't have the manpower to invest, you know, hours and hours into trying to get an extra couple thousand rand out of someone, you know, they're going to really heavily investigate and spend a lot of time on people who might owe them, you know, 100K or more than that, or a couple hundred thousand or whatever the case may be. And also in the case of debts and stuff, you're right in the sense that they in a way do want to make sure that they don't completely destroy your business, you know, because if they need all this money from you now, and then that means your business closed down and you don't earn future income and you're not going to pay tax in the future, that negatively affects them. So they are understanding, you know. I can't say that anyone should be incentivized to just be like lax about it or take chances hoping that SARS is going to be lenient with them. But at the end of the day,
so nice, can you repeat that, Jimmy?
I was just saying, I can't, you know, I'm obviously not recommending that anyone tries to like avoid their tax obligations
or
is just unnecessarily lax about it all under the assumption that SARS is going to be lenient with them if something goes wrong. You know, you still have to meet your tax obligations. But if you are ever in a difficult position, it's good to know at the end of the day that you're dealing with human beings on the other side who are going to have a degree of understanding. That doesn't mean that they're not going to demand you pay that 100K, you know, but there's some degree of understanding at least.
Cool. Okay, let's move on to a couple of slightly shorter questions there. Okay, so cool. We talked a little bit about deductibles, and you said, you know, maybe the best way, you're not, no one's really doing the shoebox anymore. It's more a case of your, between your savings account or between your bank account, your credit card account, and then any digital apps that you might use to pay for stuff. That's probably most of your records are going to be in there.
Yeah.
What are the major exceptions like petrol logbook and especially home office? I've heard it's quite complicated. Is that worth
it? Yeah. So it's interesting that you've brought up those particular two, because those are really the two that you need to be aware of the complexities around.
Hashtag research.
Like I said in the beginning, any expense that you incur in the production of your income is going to be at least partially tax deductible. And that might be things like stationery or cell phone or internet or web hosting or advertising or whatever the case may be. Certain expenses become tricky to prove how much of that expense is actually tax deductible. And so the kind of typical examples here would be petrol and vehicle related expenses and then home office related expenses. So let's just talk about the vehicle one first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you use your car for business, then technically a portion of all your vehicle-related expenses should be tax deductible. Those expenses would include, obviously, your petrol, parking, insurance, repairs and maintenance, even depreciation of the value of your vehicle. All of those expenses have to be apportioned, and the way that you work out how much to apportion it by is going to be based on a logbook that tracks your physical mileage. So if you've driven your car, you know, 30% for business, then that means 30% of all those various expenses is going to form a tax deductible expense for you. Now, that logbook is compulsory. A lot of people don't keep track of it, you know. SARS doesn't always ask for it, but it doesn't change the fact that you are supposed to have it. So if SARS does ask for it, you can't just say, sorry, I just kind of like thumb sucked that number, you know? So you need to be aware of that. So for a lot of people, that means that they're going to keep track of a logbook on a day by day basis. For some people, it means that at the end of the tax year, they're just going to go through their diary and like to the best of their ability, they're going to construct their logbook, and that's sort of based on their actual, you know, traveling throughout the year. And for some people, it means that they're just not going to keep the logbook because it's not worth their time, really. If you only use your car a little bit for business and it's only going to maybe bring your tax bill down by 1,000 rand, then maybe you're in the position of thinking that it's not worth you keeping track of this logbook every day to save 1,000 rand if it's going to, you know, mean spending 10 hours over the year doing
it. Yeah.
If
your rate is 500 rand, it's 5,000 rands worth of time you just spend saving 1,000 rands. So there's definitely
Exactly. Yeah, the opportunity cost. The other complicated expenses, as you mentioned, was home office related expenses. So, I mean, what this basically is claiming tax deduction for a portion of your home that you use for business. So the reasoning, once again, is that, you know, someone who works, is self-employed and works from home might end up renting or buying a home that is bigger than they would have bought otherwise because they need this, you know, separate room to use as an office. So then at least a portion of your home-related expenses, whether it's rent or interest on your bond payments, cleaning and stuff like that, is going to be tax deductible. And that portion is going to be based on the physical area of your home that is used for business. So that comes down to actually measuring the space, knowing the total area of your home and working out that proportion. There are also some kind of additional requirements for that space to make it eligible. And that's basically that the space has to be used regularly and exclusively for business purposes. So if your office is also like your kids' playroom, not that you would work with your kids necessarily playing around, but in that kind of example, that is not an exclusive business space. You can't argue that you wouldn't have that space if you weren't working for yourself. So that would be an issue. You also can't have another office. Like if you're a freelancer who primarily works for one client and you work at that client's office, and the fact that you also work from home in the evenings doesn't really change the fact that you've already got an office space. Obviously, there are exceptions, like if you work primarily at one client's office, but you have a lot of other work that you can't do there, and you do that work from home, then obviously you could potentially claim a home office expenses, and you would just justify that to SARS if they were to ask anything about it.
Right. So in the ideal situation for reducing costs here, like for example, I've got we bought a house which does have a spare room for me to use exclusively as an office. So it's about 3 meters by 4 meters. So that'll give you a square meterage of, you know, 12 square meters.
Yeah.
And then look at your overall house size. You find out what percentage, let's say that this room is 10% of the total size of the house. And then I can get 10% off things like, say, for example, rental.
You would claim 10% of your rental as a tax deduction, and then you would get an amount off of that based on your tax rate. So the actual discount that you get off your rent might only be, like, in the case of a 10% home office space, you might only save like 3% of your rent.
Right. If that makes sense. If I'm paying 30% tax.
Yeah.
So that day, sorry, my brain immediately goes, loophole. Let's find a loophole here. The lounge is my office. The lounge and kitchen are now my
biggest
office.
Room in my house. Yeah, exactly. But they'll
like it's possibly master is now my house. Everybody
it doesn't fly. Like, you know, a bathroom is not a workspace. A kitchen is not a workspace. Oh. If you have two kitchens in your home, and one of them is used specifically for your work, and you're a food photographer, then maybe, you know. Okay. But yeah, I mean, there have been times where I ask a person, okay, well, you know, what percentage of your home is like your designated business area? And they're like, oh, 70%, because there's also my bathroom that I use and my kitchen. And I'm just like, sorry, that doesn't fly, you know? And in the case that you work from your bed or like your couch in the lounge, that's also technically not applicable. I mean, there's a degree of understanding. I mean, my flat is basically one room. I don't have a separate room as an office, but I do have a pretty clearly like office-related corner where I've got all my work-related stuff. So I'll base my calculations on this particular corner, you know, and I've never had any issues with that. As long as the space
do
is
that?
Legitimately used for business.
Do you claim? Okay. And in general, say, like just thinking about the average, let's say the average creative is living in a small house or an apartment there, maybe they can claim, let's say 10 to 20% of the space they use is their home office. Are they going to get a saving that is worth justifying it, calculating it, going and spending that time?
For sure. I mean, I'll just do a quick calculation. So let's say someone's... it's
3% here. On your then a little bit on your internet and a little bit on your car and then it snowballs into something bigger.
Yeah. Right. So let's say someone spends 10,000 rand a month on rent and they also spend let's just leave it at that. So then that's 120k for the year. And then let's say this person's home is 15% office space.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an 18,000 Rand tax deduction. And then let's say they, you know, roughly in the 30% tax bracket, then they'll be getting back like $6,000, you know, which right. definitely, in my opinion, more than covers the time that you have to spend to like measure the space and you know, sure. potentially write a letter or take some photos to show SARS.
And you only have to do that once, right?
Well, I mean,
in terms of the calculations and the
unless you moved. I mean, it could happen that every year SARS asks you again to justify it or to mm-hmm. show them the calculations and stuff. But obviously, if you're not moving and your office space stays the same, you can just remember those percentages and stuff.
Right. Okay. Cool. So that's not as so. It might definitely be worth doing then. So that's now in terms of the travel stuff. Is there an app rather than a booklet, or what do you recommend for recording travel expenses?
That's a question I can't really answer because mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of experience with using any particular apps. I know some clients of mine have like a tracker which tracks their mileage, so they can send me out. They can send me a spreadsheet just showing me literally every single trip that they did, but they still have to then go through and say like which ones were work related and which weren't. So that's fine. I can't recommend any particular apps or trackers though.
I'm sure they're out there though, so people can do a lot of research.
I'm sure they are. A lot of them, like, you pay for, or you get like a little like dongle that you keep in your car or something like that, or it might work through a tracker that's built into your car already, you know, for sure.
In the world of stuff. Big Brother surveillance that we're heading towards, you know, it might eventually be the case that, like, you know, your phone or your car knows when it's going to a place, and then it hooks up to your Google Calendar, which knows that you're going to a business meeting, and then only records that thing, you know.
So, you know, I don't know of any particular apps that are great. I don't really keep track of a logbook for myself anymore because I used to drive a lot more for business. These days I walk a lot or I have meetings closer to home. And my clients have never really sent me logbooks, you know, from some kind of app or something like that.
I always wondered about this one because you get Uber for Business, and I always thought, like, why don't we all just use Uber for Business so that that's tracked on a business account or on a business card so that you know that those expenses are for work and otherwise, so that let someone else do that or let something else completely handle it, unless you're doing deliveries, of course. But I always wondered about, because I looked at it for a company as well and went like, this is way easier to track and it's safer for everybody working for you so that you know what the, so that there's no, like, people can't claim for things that they can't, that they're not really
using. I mean, if you're getting around with Uber, then you don't necessarily need to keep track of a logbook. You just need to track which Uber trips were business related. And if you want to set up like two cards on your Uber account and always pay for the business related trips from the one card, that's going to make it very easy for you to just see exactly how much you spent on those Uber related trips. I mean, business related trips. The one thing I also just want to mention about the logbook, which I didn't say before, is that when it comes to business mileage, driving like to and from an office, like your office or your client's office where you work, does not count as business-related mileage because everyone does that, whether you're salaried or not. But driving additional to that, like if you drive to see clients or suppliers, or, you know, if you work in film and you drive out to locations and stuff, that kind of mileage would be business-related.
Right. So, I mean, to sum up the travel thing, then I think that the cases in which someone would bother to keep a logbook are probably in the minority. I think most of us, especially in the pandemic, are mostly working from home. We're doing more Zoom calls. We're not having as many business meetings as we used to. So, for those of you who are in the position where, I think the production company is actually a good example. Like if you are working on shoots and you're going out to shoot stuff in the Karoo or something, then obviously that's something with recording. But your average 50 to 150 Rand trip every couple of weeks is not going to have a massive impact on your savings.
No. Yeah. It's like, you know, if your logbook says you drive for business like 3% of the time, it's probably not even worthwhile for you to have kept that logbook.
Right.
But obviously everyone's situation is a bit different. You know, if maybe your percentage of driving is not much, but you have like a really expensive car and so the depreciation is huge. You know, in that case, maybe it does make sense, even if you only drive 10% for business or whatever the case may be.
Right. Do you mind elaborating on that
50%.
One?
Yeah. So, you know, of all of these different vehicle related expenses, you know, depreciation can have quite a big effect. So as an example, a car as an asset tends to depreciate over, let's say, 5 years. So if you buy a car for 200,000, that means every year it's depreciating by 40,000 Rand. Now, if you drive your car 50% for business, that means 20,000 of that 40,000 Rand is a tax deductible expense. That might outweigh all your petrol by far. You know, if your car costs 500,000 Rand, then your depreciation every year is 100K. And once again, if you drive your car 50% for business, that depreciation expense is 50,000 Rand. I mean, and that can bring your tax down a whole lot. So it's worth keeping that in mind as well. Obviously, if your car is old, you've had it now for more than 5 years, it's not going to make a difference anyway.
Okay. Another useful exception.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I do for my clients often is if they haven't been keeping a logbook, but they want to know if it's worthwhile, I normally just say, okay, well, give me an estimate for how much you use your car for business. And obviously any listeners can work this out themselves probably. But based on that estimate, figure out how much tax you would save. And if it looks like you'd save yourself like 10 grand a year in tax, then you're like, okay, cool. Well, maybe I should keep this logbook. And if it works out that you're only saving 1 grand, then, you know, maybe you decide against it. Sure. But you can make that decision based on an estimate. And then going forward, keep track of your mileage so you can obviously calculate the actual amount.
Yeah. I would say that in the logbook case, there are definitely apps out there, but a small book in your visor or kept in the side pocket of your doors is a pretty good option as well. Just do it old school.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Old school. Interesting. Fine, I always wondered what the incentive was for these guys to have these like expensive cars. And so there is some money comes back. So it offsets. So you're not paying that. Like you said, it's probably based on new cars. So it's very interesting to know that there is an incentive to have a more expensive car and also get that lease out of the way every 5 years or whatever that is.
But keep in mind that the amount of tax you save is always going to be outweighed by the amount of extra money you had to spend.
Of course.
You know, so,
of course. But there's a little bit of offset. So it's not, I'm not saying it's a discount, but there is a, I hate to use this word, it is playable. Does sound like you can factor that into your car, the cost of running, your running cost of that car.
Yeah, yeah, so, exactly. Like if you're willing to spend 500K but not 600K, but the car costs 600 and you realize it's going to save you 100K worth of tax, then maybe you end up buying the car. Yeah. Like personally, I don't see the value in buying expensive cars. But if that's the kind of thing that makes you happy and you want to buy a nice car, like maybe it's going to save you some tax as well. So it doesn't cost as much.
Even if you've just got an expensive car that isn't nice. I mean, Lucas has got a Land Rover Defender. So if you count all the repair costs up, you know, you could be making a profit from SARS just by having that car.
I think the SARS was sending a letter and said, he has a match. Just throw this on the table. Let it go, man. Let it go.
Just let it go. Yeah. Okay. Let's get on to a topic that was covered in your article, Julian, which is turnover tax, which sounds like the tax for dumbasses, basically. Can you explain that a little bit?
Okay. So turnover tax is an entirely different system. Like, you know, like I said earlier, provisional tax and income tax are the same thing. Turnover tax is entirely different. And if you're registered for turnover tax, you aren't registered for income tax. Now, normal income tax is going to be based on your taxable income, which is your income minus your relevant expenses. Whereas turnover tax is based on your total turnover, which means you don't get to deduct anything before calculating your tax. So in that way, it's much simpler for people to basically administer that tax. They only need to keep track of one number throughout the year, which is the total amount of money coming in. They don't need to keep books about all the different expenses and stuff. So it does make tax more accessible for certain businesses who maybe if it wasn't for turnover tax, wouldn't pay tax at all because they just wouldn't be able to keep on top of the admin and stuff like that. That said, you know, the turnover tax was designed for, you know, small businesses that operate with really low profit margins that do have a lot of expenses and stuff. And that's why the turnover tax rates are so small. It's definitely not designed for individuals who you know, provide services with high profit margins and stuff. That said, you know, the definition of turnover tax or the requirements, you know, that outline who qualifies are quite vague. So you do get cases where someone kind of like gets into the system, they save a lot of tax, but you know that the system wasn't necessarily intended for someone like them. Also, because these requirements are so vague, you often don't really know if you actually do qualify for turnover tax. And you might register and you might say on the application, cool, I qualify. But then a couple of years down the line, SARS can look into that, maybe audit you, decide you don't qualify for turnover tax, and then it'll reopen all your old assessments and tax you again. And obviously, the only thing worse than paying SARS a large amount of money is paying them a large amount of money that you already spent a couple of years ago. So turnover tax basically attempts to exclude individuals providing professional services. They do mention a couple specific fields that fall under the definition of professional services. I'm not going to read them all, but for example, you know, accounting, financial services, information technology, research, management, broadcasting, auctioneering. There's a whole bunch of things, consulting. And they furthermore say that these fields need to be interpreted in their absolute broadest sense. So, you know, when I once queried, for example, does a graphic designer fall under the turnover tax umbrella? The SA Institute of Tax Professionals, who are the kind of governing body that I operate through, or that kind of grants me the authority to be a tax practitioner, I posed that question to them, and their opinion was that someone like a graphic designer is also, in a sense, a consultant, you know? It's like, you don't just do a design for a client. You also consult with them about what their objectives are. You make recommendations and give guidance around how they can achieve their objectives, you know, how the visual identity of the company plays into that. And obviously, you use very specific knowledge to kind of give that guidance. And because of that, often a particular field will still fall under consulting or something like that, even if you're not, you know, marketing yourself as a graphic design consultant or something like that. So, right. I mean, long story short, you need to be very careful about going onto the turnover tax system to make sure you really do qualify, because if you don't and you get caught down the line, it's really not going to be pretty. For those that do qualify for turnover tax, you can inevitably save quite a lot of tax. But once again, for each person, it's different. It really does make sense, if you're considering it, to talk to a tax professional so that they can look at your situation, look at what kind of level of expenses you have, and see if it really would save you money to go on that system, basically, and if you are eligible.
So broadly, who is it advantageous for? I mean, who is the right fit for turnover tax in the creative freelancing world, if there is anyone?
Almost nobody, in my opinion. Right. It's more for like individuals who operate businesses, maybe buying and selling goods or manufacturing things, obviously having high costs for materials and stuff like that, but really not service-based at all. I guess in the context of the creative, you know, fields, freelancers, I'd say someone who works as like as an artist, purely just as an artist, like makes work and sells it through a gallery or something like that, they could qualify for turnover tax. But someone who makes art as a graphic designer or as an illustrator, not necessarily in that case, you know?
Okay, cool. Okay.
Can I ask you, just on top of that, sorry, John.
Yeah, go ahead.
So let's say, because in the world of hustles and side hustles, some people are illustrators, some people are graphic designers. Some people are selling, they've got book deals or making a book and saying they want part of the sales, and they're getting income by that, because it's not just one revenue stream happening with a lot of these
things.
So in my head, where do you sit then? Because then, like the one is a service, and the other is a you manufacturing something. Let's just say for argument.
So the kind of rule is that if more than 20% of your income comes from one of these professional services, then you'll be excluded. So that 20% is where you draw the line. If you know what I'm saying? If you have multiple streams, but the one that falls potentially out of the turnover tax umbrella is accounted for more than 20% of your income, then you won't qualify. I mean, there are a bunch of other requirements for turnover tax too, and I'm not going to go into all that detail right now. But obviously, for anyone who is interested in the system, they can get in touch with a tax professional, or they can just do some Googling. But for example, you know, you can't have a turnover more than R1 million. Obviously, can't earn more than 20% of your income from providing professional services. There's also some exclusions related to people who fall under the personal service provider umbrella, which is also maybe just getting a little bit too technical for now. Mm-hmm. But just don't register yourself for turnover tax without like really checking with the professional first.
Okay. Sure. Cool. Okay. I've heard the tax dates are shifting because of COVID-19. Is that true or is that just a lie?
Yeah. So there's not a whole lot of information about it, to be honest. Even me as a tax professional, I'm not hearing a lot. And I'm also not hearing, you know, other people in this tax association that I'm a part of. I'm talking about it a lot in the forums and stuff. But basically what SARS has proposed is that the normal tax season has basically shifted. Whereas it normally starts at the 1st of July, it's now starting officially on the 1st of September. This period now between June and August, they're using as a time for people to like make sure that all their details are verified, like their banking details and stuff are all up to date with SARS. And they're also using the period to conduct auto assessments on certain people. So obviously some people don't have to file tax returns at all because they don't meet the requirements. And for some other people that do have to file tax returns, but where SARS already has all this person's information from third-party providers like their employer and investment companies and all that stuff like that, SARS is offering some of these people to have their returns auto-assessed. And that's going to be happening, you know, between now and the 1st of September. Essentially, from the 1st of September is where anyone who hasn't been auto-assessed can file their tax returns. Now, the one kind of weird exception, which they haven't clarified a whole lot, is that they say that certain individuals who SARS isn't waiting on any information from third-party providers and stuff will be allowed to file their tax returns before the 1st of September. And I assume that that could mean most individuals, provided that their employers or their clients have submitted IRP5s and stuff like that. So from my practice's perspective, I'm still assuming that from the 1st of July, I'm going to be submitting a lot of tax returns. But in reality, I don't know how many of my clients might be forced to wait out until that next, until the 1st of September when the filing season officially starts. SARS have said that individuals who fall into that category will be notified, you know, via SMS and email. So I'm not sure if SARS will notify me with regards to my clients, but I've told my clients that if they do receive such a message, obviously to let me know. But yeah, to answer your question, there are these changes. I think it might not affect people that much, but I really don't know for sure, to be honest.
Sure.
I'll just have to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask another question? I don't know if you were going to get to this. I was checking on the resource cost, on the resource fee that a lot of guys are getting foreign currency in, working, getting, then there were questions of how does that work? How does tax work on foreign currency? And also best ways probably, and I don't know maybe if this is in your thing, but best ways to take payment or take the transfer of that money.
So as a South African tax resident, you know, if you live here and you work here, even if you earn income from other sources, you know, around the world, you're still liable for tax on that money in South Africa. There are exceptions. For example, if you've earned money abroad while abroad and that money has already been taxed and stuff like that. But let's say for someone who is a freelancer and you've got one client who's based overseas, they pay you regularly in dollars or whatever the case may be. That money is taxable in South Africa. And the amount that should be declared on your tax return has to be obviously the kind of rand adjusted amount. SARS has official exchange rates, you know, for each day and from various countries, they'll tell you what the official exchange rate is for that day. So if you got paid on the 25th of September, you go and look what's the rand dollar official exchange rate on that day and you convert your amount. That's what you'll declare as your income right. on your return. If you have things like fees for the conversion of foreign currency and stuff like that, those kind of fees are tax deductible expenses because, you know, you wouldn't be spending that if you hadn't earned that money. So you should only be taxed on what you earned after deduction of those kind of fees and stuff like that.
Okay, interesting. So, payment or Payoneer or some of the various platforms that people are talking about, then you get your payments. That's the total figure. You figure out what the exchange rate was on that day. But then do you do that for the amount minus say the 5% that the platform took off. So you take that away from the initial from that calculation.
Yeah. So you would probably want to calculate the rand value of the whole payment and then deduct that fee as a kind of separate amount, as opposed to deducting it first and then declaring the income, which is like net of those fees, if that makes sense. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Good question, Luke, because I think that a lot of people do have like one overseas client, and a lot of people are certainly actively looking for overseas clients because the rand is so poked right now. That's useful
stuff.
So
worth keeping in mind. So normally income earned abroad could be tax exempt if you were actually outside of the country while earning that money. But there are exceptions to that. You know, if like, especially for someone who's working as a freelancer, because when it comes to the exemption of income earned abroad, it only applies to like salary-based income. So if I go abroad and I still just keep working as a freelancer, I'm still technically going to have to pay money on that tax on that money in South Africa. So it's complicated. And I think that anyone who is in that position should just make sure that they are filing their returns accurately by, you know, possibly consulting with a professional. Because I think, I mean, it probably goes without saying, but a lot of what I'm talking about today is, you know, generalized. And I don't think anyone should take it as the 100% most appropriate advice for their personal situation. It's just things to be aware of and to possibly approach a professional to advise further if you know some of these things apply to you, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Did a little message pop up as this is a disclaimer right on your screen. Remember to tell them.
It's
completely right. I want to make more big deal about that
kind of thing.
Yeah, I just want to make a big deal about the idea that this is advice, not gospel. And yes, a professional should be.
Terms and conditions apply.
Financial advice is very dangerous, especially, you know, if I was just a random person, like a friend of your guys, just talking about like stuff that I read online, I can say whatever I want in terms of advice, and I can tell people, oh, you should invest in that product, or you should do this and that. But as someone who's actually qualified as a financial advisor, it's very like dangerous for me to say stuff where people could interpret that to mean like personal advice to them, you know? Because everyone's situation is a little bit different. And if you go act on some like advice that fits 90% of people but doesn't fit you, you could actually then, you know, come and get me into trouble for that. So advice in the legal sense.
Can you actually clear up for me, because I've noticed that there seems to be two different kinds of financial planner or advisors that you get, where one of them is will never give you advice. They'll be like, this is one option and this is another option, and some people do this and some people do that. But when what most people are crying out for is like, please just tell me what the best thing to do is, is that like a different certification or a different type of planner?
Maybe just a different type of approach. I think for a financial planner or financial advisor who's quite analytical and maybe dealing with analytical clients, it's nice to just give them as much information as possible for them to make an informed decision. Because, I mean, obviously no financial advisor has a crystal ball, and I can't ever say to anyone, despite how much I know, I can never say to anyone, do this. It's definitely going to work out more beneficial for you than doing that. Sure. But then you also get other people in the financial services industry who are obviously just very focused on selling products. And so they are going to say to you, you should for sure buy this exact product from me. Don't worry about the fact that I can't provide you products from any other provider. This is the right one for you. And obviously that's where you need to question whether that is sincere advice or not.
Sure. Absolutely. So you basically, I think every financial advisor has made it pretty clear to me that, sorry, my mic just changed over. There we go. Makes clear to me that in the end, the decision is mine and they're providing me with the information that they can, and you, I have to take full responsibility for any decisions made. So unfortunately, yeah. I think for creative freelancers who would rather have someone just give you a recommendation and have that work, like you have to adult up a little bit and you have to take responsibility for the decisions that are made.
You at least have to take responsibility to make sure that you understand the advice that you're given and you understand why the advisor feels it's appropriate for you, you know? Like if someone wants to invest some money, like let's say someone wants to park their money somewhere before they pay their provisional tax. If I went and said to that person, you should invest in this like super aggressive high equity fund that's extremely volatile, that would be terrible advice from my side. And if they acted on that advice, they could probably sue me if something went wrong. But if I say to a person, you should invest in this really conservative thing that's not going to fluctuate much, but they say, well, I really want to invest in the high equity aggressive thing, I can say, sure, well, that's probably not a great idea, but if you're happy to do it and take the risk, then that's fine, you know? Mm. So you just need to know what you're getting into and know whether it makes sense from a financial perspective. And if you are taking risk, you need to be aware of the risk that you are taking, you know?
Sure.
And accept that.
So I think, Luke, unless there's anything burning in your mind, I think we're kind of running out of time with Julian here. And I want to do a little bit of a collect everything together for a bit of a summary here. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, go for it, man. Yeah, this. I just wanted to say this is super informative. Thank you very much.
Good.
I can imagine you meeting with people and the subject is quite dry. But for some reason, it feels like you have clarified very in very simple forms with very little jargon. My basic thing is if I could kind of understand what was going on and I got the gist of it, it's good because I'm a moron when it comes to stuff. So just thanks.
Cool.
That's Lucas speaking for most creative freelancers, I think.
Yeah. I guess I can understand the perspective that most creatives come from. And I know that me just showing them a bunch of like tables and numbers and throwing out technical terms is not going to help them at all, you know. But when it becomes relevant to talk about that stuff, then, you know, then I do. If we need to go deeper into a topic, then fair enough.
Sure. I think, this is based upon like my personal experience. Like I'm going to give a recommendation here. I'm not a professional. So, you know, I'm not liable for any of this advice I'm giving you. But my advice is to connect with a professional like Julian.
Buy Bitcoin. Yes,
buy Bitcoin. Lots of silver. Yeah, give all your money to me. No, yeah. My recommendation is to talk to a tax professional because, I mean, Julian's prices are on his website, julianbrookstone.com. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
So you can get a kind of a transparent look of what it's going to cost you. And I think that given the amount of turnover and income that most people will make over a year, the investment in the services of a tax professional are relatively small percentage of that compared to the amount of anxiety that a lot of you might be feeling right now. The amount of
and
money
amount of time.
Therapy and medication is just not worth it. Exactly. Time. The time value of money is just a very real thing. So,
yeah.
You can just sling them the, you know, as you said, you can actually do the e-filing for your clients to the point that I don't have to go to the SARS website and, you know, be super intimidated by it. So if you trust the
person, you know, I can basically do everything for someone. Well, any tax practitioner can basically do everything for you. You just need to give them the information that they need, you know, to do their job, whether that's your bank statements or a Excel sheet that you've drawn up summarizing everything. Obviously, some people might want to be very hands-on and handle their tax themselves, and that's fine. Just understand, you know, you're going to have to educate yourself a lot about that stuff, and you're going to have to spend a lot of time doing that. And if to you that is valuable and you want to go ahead doing your tax yourself, that's fine. Most people don't really want to think about it. They want to focus on doing their job, you know, running their business, whatever that may be. In which case, having a tax professional helping you out is going to definitely help you feel a lot less anxious about this stuff. And it's just going to make the process much smoother, I think, especially if it gets to the point of getting audited or reviewed or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if you're heavily, well, in arrears, or if you haven't filed for a few years and you're feeling that building anxiety like I did, let me tell you, it is a massive weight off your chest when you get in contact with a professional and they're like, yeah, send me your bank statements and have it sorted out. And then 2 weeks later, it's sorted out. Like, he says, no, everything's squared with SARS. There were some fees, but we managed to reduce them, and we're getting that. We're getting your what is it called again? Tax return. You're getting your return, which will annul those fees anyway. Like, it was amazing for me. So yeah, I recommend it.
There's just one thing I think I just want to bring up that's quite important for freelancers to realize, and I guess it's just a little extra bit of information. Is a lot of freelancers do have tax deducted on their behalf. It's always going to be at a rate of like 25% because that's the standard that companies deduct on behalf of freelancers. Very important to realize that just because a company might be deducting tax on your behalf doesn't mean that everything is okay, because that 25% is kind of just an arbitrary figure. And if your income has been very high, it could work out that that particular 25% wasn't enough, or it could work out that it was more than enough. So either way, you should be filing a tax return if you're in that kind of boat, just to make sure that the amount of tax you end up paying is accurate based on your actual income for the year. I've seen a lot of people fall into traps around that. So I thought just best to bring it up now.
Yeah, just to elaborate on that. So for example, my experience is that usually happens with large corporate clients. Like if you're working for the Fashini Group or a bank or whatever it might be, then they'll take the tax off. What am I supposed to do in that situation?
I generally recommend to people, if some company that you're working for wants to deduct the tax on your behalf, just let them do it, because at least then you don't need to worry about that. Sometimes that 25% works out to be a higher percentage than what is actually required based on their actual taxable income for the year. But sometimes that means that the tax that some clients deduct helps offset the tax that some other clients don't deduct. So I guess for the most part, if someone is forcing you to have tax deducted from your income, just, you know, deal with it. Keep in mind that it is helping you out in the long run. If you are unsure about whether that 25% is appropriate or not, maybe chat to a tax professional or just do some tax estimations, you know, using some calculators online, and just figure out how much tax you should actually be keeping aside. If it's somewhere in the ballpark of 25%, cool, just have them do that for you. If it turns out you should be paying much more tax, just bear in mind that even though they're already deducting some, you still need to keep some more aside. And obviously the flip side, if it turns out they're deducting more than enough, you could potentially even apply for a tax directive and get them to deduct a lower amount. But the lowest rate that can be deducted based on a tax directive is 18%, so it doesn't make the hugest difference.
Sure, right. I think that just speaks to the point of talking to a professional.
Yeah, sorry. Maybe that got a bit.
No. It's an important look. I mean, it confused the hell out of me the first time I worked for a client who took tax off, and I was like, I'm not a salaried worker anymore. Why are you taking my tax off? You're just making life more complicated for me. But the fact is that these big companies that you might contract for are bureaucracies, and you're never going to change. It's difficult to fight them on anything.
Yeah. So legally, they're supposed to deduct that amount. To be honest, when you work for a client that doesn't deduct that amount, that is actually kind of more like the exception, where they kind of should, but they just don't. They're not really necessarily getting in trouble for it, you know, especially if they're not a big company. But don't try fight with a big company that is arguing to have tax deducted from your income, because technically they're just doing what the law requires them to do.
Right. Okay. Cool. Great. Julian, thank you so much for your time, mate. Where can our listeners find you if they are looking for some help or want to read the article? I will link to the article you wrote directly in the show notes, but otherwise...
Yeah, my one single blog post that I've ever written.
It's going to be the most effective blog post you've ever written.
Yeah. It has helped a lot because I refer a lot of people to it when they come to me with a lot of questions, and they're like, oh, cool, I don't have questions anymore. So it saves me some time. But yeah, people can... obviously check my website out, julianbrookstone.com. So the website talks about my tax stuff, but also my financial planning practice. So you know, if you're looking for someone to help you with either of those things, that's cool. For tax, if you want to get in contact, just email me, tax@julianbrookstone.com. My cell phone number is also available on my website, but to be honest, it's just best to contact me via email unless it's urgent, because for the most part, I'll get back to you sooner if you email me than if you called, you know, especially sure. If I've had a meeting or something. Email is always very easy to keep track of, so I'll never miss anything on email.
Sure. Yeah. Otherwise, if you guys are on the creative or the resource creative forum, you can search within the group for just look for the word tax. And I mean, I got Julian's details out of a thread about someone asking for a reliable tax professional. So if nice. You hate the sound of Julian's voice or think that we're on the payroll, then you can go and check that out. And there's also a few links in there to additional resources and all that. Is the SARS website worth a visit?
Mostly not really. You can check on it if you need to be reminded about specific important dates, like when the filing season starts and ends, or if you have specific questions about certain aspects of tax. If you Google, you'll often find a link to like a SARS page that explains that thing. But sure. I kind of think that for the most part, if you're getting to the point where you're having to do that stuff, just save yourself the time and effort and have a professional just give you some advice, at least initially, you know. Like, I have nothing wrong with people handling their own taxes, but it really does help to just get started off on the right foot by talking to someone who can at least tell you, like, what you need to know about, and then you can go and research that stuff.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you for your time, Julian. Guys, that was in 90 minutes. There was a 90 minutes breakdown of tax for the tax terrified. So I hope that was useful. If you guys have any questions, feel free not to post them in the comments, because I'm not answering any of them and I don't think Julian's on the group. So just get in touch with him.
I tried to join the group before, but I was declined. So.
Oh, well, you got to put the music stuff in there. That's the problem. Tax, then yes, it just says nope.
Yeah, they probably thought I was trying to advertise, whereas I just wanted to see what people were saying about me when I get referred from the group, because it happens quite often.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Cool.
Thanks again, guys. I'm glad that I was able to join your show and hopefully help some people out.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. I think it's a major sore point for a lot of freelancers, and I think it's a great help.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, dude. We will get in touch. We'll stay in touch, and good luck for the rest of the week. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, you too. Take care.
Cheers,
guys.
Cheers.